So 7 days later is what I'm calling our chat today, right? 7 days later, because I don't know about you. 7 days later isn't always my best time. And let me tell you what I mean by that. Anyone ever get like a spiritual revelation, like you sense Jesus was talking to you about something, he kind of nailed something in your life, you might have even gotten a word of knowledge, it helps you break through something, right? And where are you at a week later? Come on, can we be honest where most of us are at 1 week after we have some kind of spiritual breakthrough? Because think about it, we're 1 week out from Easter right now. When we celebrate that, when we celebrate him being risen, which truthfully, I know we're a group of people that are into the cross, and that forgives our sins, but the resurrection is actually power to live a life fully, right? The fact that we don't have to be dead in our sins anymore, not just like getting the gold card to get into heaven, but we as Christians believe that the resurrection means I don't have to do those addictions anymore. I don't have to lean on those coping mechanisms. I don't have to be in that relationship anymore. I don't have to keep operating by those paradigms and lenses I have on. We believe that the resurrection does something that's like, dang it, we're not just putting the shock absorbers on the ride of life till we get in the pearly gates. There's something about the resurrection that means life doesn't have to continue. Anger management doesn't have to continue. And what I do when no one's looking doesn't have to continue. And I don't know about you, Jesus speaks to Jim, spoke to him a bunch of times in his journey. And where are you at typically 1 week after he speaks? Hey, let's not be ashamed, man. Cycles are hard to break. I was a little kid, man. I was one of four boys. And the only way my dad could keep us from destroying the neighborhood was he got us a round swimming pool. You remember those above ground ones? Everyone's seen them? Those aluminum ones, right? We got in at like 9 a.m. and we got out at 3 o'clock to watch Speed Racer, and then we got back in at 3:30, right? And then we swam until 6. And I was chlorine bleach blonde hair. It's why I think I don't have it anymore, right? I had chlorine diarrhea every night. I just thought that was normal. I drank so much water during that time, right? But did you ever, when you're trying to come up with 9 hours of things to do in a 16-foot wide swimming pool, you play Marco Polo till you don't even know who the guy was historically, but he made a great game. And then you get in the pool sometimes, and then you start to make the whirlpool. Ever do it? You ever do it? We used to take Mike Mansberger, and let's just say that Mike was the fullest figure guy in our neighborhood. He probably has emotional trauma from what we did to him, because we put him out front, and we would just push him to get that current going. This is a 16-foot wide pool. You ever get that current going so fast? We actually got it to the point where the center of the pool used to begin to dip down, man. And then we had one of those decks that had the ladder that went in. And you knew, even if you were underground, if there was a guy going around and he hit that ladder, you heard this boom. And you hear this, oh, you know. And we would get this thing cranking. And I don't know about you. That's the nature of sin and stupidity in my world, right? I just seem to get it cranking. And then all of a sudden, Jesus comes into my life and turns me around, right? Now, what happens when you first turn around in that swimming pool? Anyone remember? Come on, man. You're still being pushed, right? The beauty is you were smart enough to turn around. The beauty was you decided you were going to go a different direction. But I don't know about you. Being forgiven for this stupidity is one thing. I need the power to go the other way. Amen, right? And here's what happens. For a while, you lose ground. So 7 days later happens. And if we aren't part of a church that sits and admits it, I think what we do is we seed this little mild cynicism over spiritual victory, don't we? Because you got the revelation, you automatically think the whole thing's broken through. And I want to tell you something. If we're not careful to talk about the hard reality of walking forward with Jesus transformationally, even with that Billy Graham echo, this should be coming home to you, right? Sorry, Billy Graham big sound happening up there now. I want to chat about 7 days later. You're not the only person that's faced this, right? Let's look at the chapter for today. When it was evening on that day, this is the day Jesus, the women found him that morning risen from the grave. Look where the disciples are. On the first day of the week, and the doors of the house where the disciples had met were locked for fear of the Jews. Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." And after he said this, he showed them his hands and his side. Then the disciples rejoiced when they saw the Lord. Jesus said to them again, "Peace be with you. As the Father sent me, so I send you." But Thomas, who was called the twin, one of the 12, was not with them when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, "We've seen the Lord, man." But he said to them, "Unless I see the mark of the nails in his hands and put my finger in the mark of the nails and my hand in his side, I will not believe." A week later, his disciples were again in the house, and Thomas was with them. Although the doors were shut, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "Thomas, put your finger here and see my hands. Reach out your hand and put it in my side. Do not doubt, but believe." And Thomas answered him, "My Lord and my God." And Jesus said, "Oh, have you believed because you've seen me? Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have come to believe." Now, Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book, but these are written so that you may come to believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that through believing, you may have life in his name. Now, whenever I dive into a passage like this, just partly who I am is a mild nerd, right? Like, I'll go and I'll try to, like, think, like, why is John telling the story this way, right? By the way, it's partly what I'm paid to do, so let me just unpack the kind of cultural background of what's going on with John here. Because John told this, he decided to tell this story quite differently than the way Mark and Luke did, right? Matter of fact, Matthew doesn't touch it. I got theories on why Matthew doesn't even tell this one. And that's weird, because Matthew was reading Mark when he was writing his gospel. So a lot of Mark's stories are in Matthew with just Matthew color on them, right? But for this one, somehow Matthew was like, that was a tough time. Let's not talk about that or something, right? He's just kind of backing off of this story. Now, why do I unpack the need to understand John's take on this thing? Well, I don't know about you, but Christianity to me requires multiple voices to get into my world for something to break through. Anyone else, right? You know why we have a GPS? You ever have your GPS? It's how I got to Boyertown today, because Boyertown is in the way to nowhere, people. You guys are on the way to nowhere. Like, I looked by the crow flies, I should have been here in 20 minutes. An hour and 15 minutes later, east-west, man, you guys are, don't get me wrong, you're great. I mean, some would say there's more culture in yogurt. I like Boyertown, right? But I just want to remind you, you are on your way to nowhere. It's pretty awesome. So I got here this morning, right? And I had to use a GPS to get here. Now, how do we work a GPS? Three satellites shoot and triangulate me, right? It's called a triangulation. I don't know about you, but if it takes three satellites to figure out where I'm at, I think life is something like that, right? It oftentimes takes me three reference points to figure out what I'm thinking, feeling, I wait for a confirmation on it, etc. So here's one thing I wish Jesus would have done. I wish Jesus would have wrote a gospel. Come on, people. Wouldn't it have been a lot easier if it was all red letters? Straight up, man. Shane Claiborne's right on this. Just give me red letters, man. Because red letters, people can't mess with as much. But something about the fact that Jesus decided not to write a gospel was not just some kind of like, I'm busy, I'm doing ministry. It was strategic that Jesus gave us four guys, right, and a bunch of women's testimonies to tell us this. This is how we saw it, right? Now, I don't know about you, the four of them see very differently. You may not have caught some of this, right? And to show you this, I'm just going to take you to the first verse of all four of these four guys, right? Just to show you something different about it. Let's start with this guy, man. Matthew, when he wrote his gospel, it appears that he had a Jewish mind that he was after, right? He sat and when he saw Jesus doing all things Jewish. And so he starts with this, right? This is the record of the ancestors of Jesus, the Messiah, a descendant of King David and Abraham. Really? Stop, drop, and roll. Did anyone ever take a creative writing class? You ever take one of these things, man? What do they tell you to do? Your opening sentence is supposed to what? Capture people's attention, right? You remember this stuff? I want to ask you something. Here we are thinking we're the fulfillment of a couple thousand-year-old ancient religion called Judaism, and we start our New Testament, our New Covenant off with a birth order. Anyone ever find that weird? Because right after this verse, guess what happens for around the next 20 verses? So-and-so begat so-and-so, begat so-and-so. And what the world is begat? That alone freaks me out, right? And he begat this one, and this one begat that one. And I'm sitting there thinking, this is a weird way to start a revelation that God's come among us. Unless you're a Jewish mind, right? Do you know that Matthew goes on to have Jesus preaching in the synagogue more than the other three writers? Do you know that Matthew quotes more Old Testament passages than the other three guys, right? And here's a cool one. Do you know that Matthew refers to Jesus as the son of David more than the other three combined? What's up with that, right? What's going on there, Matthew boy, Matthew Jewish boy? You know, what Matthew's, when he sees Jesus, he sees the fulfillment of all things Judaism. Not this guy, man, not Mark. Mark, you're going to quickly realize, wrote the shortest of all the Gospels. He used average guy Greek. By the way, if you come to seminary and we try to teach you Greek so you can get into some of these layered meanings that are going on in the New Testament, right? If you come and study, we will never have you translate the book of Mark. Because Mark is written like construction worker Joe Sixpack language. Now, just to give an example, if Mark was writing now in English, it would go something like this. Dude, you will not believe it. He showed up, and I'm telling you, smack. I'm shook. When I was there, and he came and did that, it freaked every single person out. I don't even care if you didn't like him. You left shook. You get my drift? Now, that statement I just gave you is full of something we call colloquialism, right? It's all the little things, like the other night, my daughter and I were at like a service, and I just realized what shook meant. Like, Jesus did something in her life, she came over. I'm like, Eve, I was watching, man. Something crazy just went down there. She's like, Dad, I'm shook. I'm like, I don't know what that means, but I just think something crazy happened, right? Colloquialisms are this. That just simply means that Mark is rating like the average guy on the streets. Matter of fact, look at the way he starts his gospel. Straight to the point, shortest of all of them, written with the least amount of detail. Here begins the good news about Jesus the Messiah, the Son of God. Smack, drop the mic. Matter of fact, he doesn't even talk about Jesus next. Guess who Mark talks about? John the Baptist. Ooh, that's smart. Because the people, the Bible says this, the commoners went out to John the Baptist. He spoke like they thought. When he called them to do something, they got that. So guess how Mark actually introduces Jesus? John the Baptist, man. Mark spends more time telling the John the Baptist introduction than the other three guys. Because he knew that if I can position Jesus as someone that John the Baptist got, you're going to get this guy. Right? Here's what's crazy about Mark. Shortest of all the gospel, least amount of details. This is one of the reasons I love when Bible critics start to do like, well, Mark and Luke's gospels seem to disagree on this point. Luke says there's three people present, and the wind was blowing out of the west, and chlamydia blossoms were blown by. Very Luke, right? And Mark only says there was one. And I'm like, hot dang, if you just knew who these cats were, right, you might get a glimpse into why they talked about the story like that. But Mark not only has the shortest gospel, Mark has Jesus preaching on the streets more than any other gospel. Jesus isn't in the synagogues as much in Mark. Mark has Jesus out there. Matter of fact, I want you to go have fun and just read Mark looking for the amount of times Jesus touches somebody. Do you know that Jesus touches people in the book of Mark more than any other of the books, right? Particularly look at when he's healing in the book of Mark. It says he reached out and touched the leper. Now that alone's interesting, huh? Before he's healed, it says he reached out and touched him and then he was healed. Now there's a risky Jesus, huh? You guys know what leprosy is? I just know it's funky. You don't want that. It makes eczema look like it's standing still. So there's Mark's style, man. Matter of fact, I had this girl once. I used to, in this Bible school I was teaching, I used to make everyone in the school read the four Gospels, and they had to have a pencil, and I made them get this one book called The Harmony of the Gospels, and this cool book lays out the Gospels in lines. So if you're looking at the book, the left-hand column will be Matthew, then Mark, then Luke, and John, right? It's just four names across the top. And then what they do is they try to chronologically tell you the life of Christ. And if Luke didn't talk about it, it's just blank there. So you can kind of get a glimpse of who was talking about which stories. And then all of a sudden, John's interesting. Because John, 80% of everything in John is nowhere else in the other three, right? It's just John, like, I'll tell you why I think this was going on a little later, right? So you're reading along, and there's nothing going on in John's column. Then all of a sudden at the end, it's like, boom, all John. He just like, and dumps out these stories that we don't have. Matter of fact, this particular story, although it's one of the times he that he expressed the same story, he does way more detail on this story than the other two. I'll tell you why, right? Anyway, I had this class doing this, and then I made you read all four, and I made you do this. You had to mark every time Jesus talked to a woman or hung out with a woman. You had to mark every time he was around a religious leader. You had to mark every single time he dealt with a demon or the demonic realm, right? And then you were allowed to pick one. You were allowed to pick one, and I had all these students reading these cool things. One day, Angie Kratz comes to me. Now, just so you know, Angie Kratz was like Jesus with skin on. You didn't mess with her. Like, you acted like you were a cooler teacher than her, but you knew you were about to get passed, right? Right? And Angie actually had spent time with Mother Teresa for 6 months at the Sisters of Charity. She had that kind of story, like Christian Peace Corps stuff out, like radically affecting the world. And she decides to do this Bible school, which made me nervous because she knew Jesus more than I could teach her. But I just remember when Angie came to me like, Mr. Jim, can I please do how many times Jesus touches people in the gospel? And I'm there thinking to myself, stupid. By the way, that's what instructors are actually thinking, but we're trained not to say it out loud. That's a joke for all of you experiencing emotional trauma around your educational experiences, right? Right? I'm like, Angie, I'm thinking to myself, Angie, why in the world? Like, what? Guess what she found? Jesus touches people almost twice as much in the book of Mark. She's the one who taught me that, right? Because when she brought back her report, I'm like, hot dang, it's amazing, right? Then there's Luke, right? Then there's Luke's angle on the world. You want to see Luke's opening sentence? Look at this baby. It's called a run-on sentence, people. Check that out. This is so Luke, right? Most excellent Theophilus. Many people have written accounts about the events that took place among us. They used as their source material the reports circulating among us from the early disciples and other eyewitnesses of what God has done in his fulfillment of his promises. Whoa, but having carefully investigated all of these accounts from the beginning, I have decided to write a careful summary for you to reassure you of the truth you've been taught. Now, friends, I want to tell you something. We got to be straight up about the Bible. The Bible's real. And you're thinking I mean like legitimate. It's legitimate too, but it's actually really earthy real. Like this is Luke giving a kind of polite little academic side shrug to Mark, isn't it? Like, okay, Theophilus, I know that you've accepted Jesus, right on, good for you. And I know that you've heard the reports that have been gathered by those who were with them. But you know what? Just so you know, bless their hearts. I've applied the most rigorous, latest social scientific skills in the Greco-Roman world to figuring out exactly what took place. And I'm here now to tell you, I'm sure their stuff was good. I'm here to reassure you. If you read this, you're going to really get it. Now, friends, you might be like, well, Jim, yeah, I think you're adding, yeah, I probably am having a little bit of hyperbole in all this, right? Exaggerating it slightly. But there's a slight hint here. And we know this, Luke goes on to write the longest of the Gospels by far, and up until the year 300, they used to call the book of Acts Luke 2. It wasn't until the year 300 that they actually began to call it the Acts of the Apostles. Up till that point, everybody knew that this guy just kept writing. He had issues, man. You know? Like, you give him an assignment, I need a 10-page report, he's like, I'm going to show you all about it 40 pages later. And I write, like, will not read. Right? Luke just goes off, uses the most complicated of Greek because he's deeply going into meanings. Now, here's what's interesting about Luke. By the way, I'm sorry to put you through a 3-credit course in the Gospels. Y'all okay with this? Is this cool? This is just my intro. We're in trouble right now. No, this isn't the intro. It's just having fun. But do you know that Luke, guess what number one phrase he uses for Jesus is? Son of man. No one else really uses it. Now, why would Luke do that? Because the Luke I know is writing to the educated Greek and Jew. They were called Hellenized Jews, right? And he knew this, that the Greeks had this view of what's called the perfect man. Anyone ever read Plato's The Cave? That out of it will come these perfect forms of the way it really is. And one day a man will come among us. If you ever seen Michelangelo's resurrected Greek revival architecture of Michael, of David. You ever seen the statue of David by Michelangelo? Perfect proportions in that kind of posture of the perfect being presented to you, right? The Greeks had this idea that one day the perfect one would come among us. And guess what Luke does? Oh, bless your hearts. Forget. The Son of Man came among us, which was a fancy phrase to say this, the firstborn of us all, the one that was going to show us all. I just love Luke hijacking that phrase from the Greeks, right, and using it to explain who Jesus was to them. Now, then there's this last guy, the guy that I'm trying to intro to get back to the story, John. Now, there's something you might need to think about John and when he wrote. John's gospel was believed to be the last of the New Testament books we have written, right? He wrote John 1, 2, and 3 even before he wrote the Gospel of John. I don't think John ever intended to write a gospel. I think for personality reasons, I think because he was a contemplative more than what we would call a classic evangelist, meaning he sat around and meditated on the being of Christ, kind of like the beloved relationship that he had, right? I don't think he ever meant to sit down and write a gospel. We believe he wrote it somewhere between 85 and 90. Matter of fact, most of the apostles are dead by now. But there's something you need to know that was going on in the church. There was this Greek thing called Gnosticism. And it was really, really, really popular in the first century world, right? And it was this belief that there is flesh here and there's spirit here, and you're caught in flesh. But if you can learn some secret sayings, these secret sayings and beliefs will eventually set you free, that you can elevate out of flesh. And once you've pleased the gods through the elevation of finding these secret sayings, you will move into a purely spirit state and be separated from dirty flesh. So, as Gnostics began to get saved, they heard the message of Jesus, or they got healed, or something crazy happened in the world, and they began to come into the church. They didn't leave this thought behind, so they began to think like, oh, well, God did send Jesus, but he was the perfect guy. And he's still worthy enough to forgive us of our sins because he lived perfectly. And his dying on the cross still saved us. But this whole like God and flesh thing, no, just so you know, flesh is dirty. Certainly, the spirit realm would not come and touch the flesh. And so I don't know if you know this, man. We're almost done this nerd out. There was this big meeting that took 4 years in the year 400. It's called the Council of Nicaea. You ever seen this thing called the Nicene Creed, right? You ever read that thing in church or something, right? This council met just to debate this. 4 years it took them to debate this. And guess which gospel they ended up quoting the most? The Gospel of John. Because you want to know what John did when he sat down to write his gospel? He threw all chronology to the wind. He's like, forget the order it happened. John sat down and thought to himself, when did Jesus say he was God? When did Jesus say he was God among us, right? And here's an interesting little tidbit, and it's my last in nerding out on you, right? Then I'll try to give you a message. Do you know that Jesus makes more deity claims in the book of John than the other three combined? I don't know about you, I find that interesting. John decided when he was writing his gospel, the only thing he was interested in was doing what? You're going to have to decide. If you don't believe he claimed to be God, then you shouldn't bother believing at all. He's either a lunatic or a liar, right? Or the great C.S. Lewis thing. Because if you don't believe that, this guy walked around constantly saying this. You know what? If you've seen me, you've seen the Father, which would have been absolutely a deity claim in that day. You understand what I'm getting at? So John lays this all out. So why did I do this? Because first I want to remind you of something. I don't know about you. You ever been in one of these theaters downtown? Sorry, I just skipped over John. The gospel to the second generation church, by the way. You ever been in one of these theaters downtown in one of these cities? You ever been to like one of these? You ever just, I'm going to take it you have, right? I tried to impress my wife at one point, and I paid for one of those round seats near the front, right? Can I tell you something? They are the worst seats in the dang house. They stink. Does anyone want to guess why they stink? Because you lose one third of the stage. You're so close. We went to see Oliver, right? And they do a lot of these dance choreographic scenes, and all of a sudden Oliver and Fagin would disappear back into the right corner, and I'd be like, I actually took our seats at one point because no one was in the spot next to us, and I moved our seats over to there because it was the movable seats. I'm just like, damn, I'm not sitting there. That's ridiculous. Now, you did get to see neat things up there. You got to see how they took the microphones and molded it into the outfit so you can barely see them. And then there was this one scene when Oliver's dancing with Fagin and they accidentally bumped into each other and Oliver knocked Fagin's like ZZ Top goatee off, right? That was Velcroed to his chin. And that actor was so good. Fagin just in one spin move picked it up and boop, was right back on. And I was like, look at that, right? Now, I don't know about you. What if we would have been on the break during intermission and I would have said, did you see? I would have just been talking to some random guy or girl and I was like, did you see that thing with Fagin, him losing his beard? And they would have looked at me and said, what? Are you a freak? That didn't happen. And I'd be like, no. Did you see that? And they're like, no. That's not how it worked. And I'm like, I'm not kidding you, man. The beard fell off. The guy was just good. He was good. And then they're telling me about a scene that goes on. And I'm like, what are you talking about? That scene wasn't. Are you smoking? Like, what's going down with you, 420 boy? And I, like, I'm just there like, what? Now, because where did it happen on the stage? The spot where I wasn't sitting. So can I just remind you one thing about the church? Jesus doesn't change. He walks out on the stage, right? Jesus walks out on the stage. Jesus is Jesus. But what ends up changing based on where you're sitting in the theater? Your take on what Jesus is up to, right? And so the one thing I want to speak to this morning is, of course I know the church looks weird and you're not sure which church to go to or which denomination to be a part of, something like that. But I want to tell you something. Rather than being bad, I actually view that Jesus deposits little pieces of himself in different communities around the world. You know what I mean? And it almost takes encountering different people. It's one of the reasons I believe we still have to do church, although I'm all into this individualistic, well, I'm just a follower of Christ and I'm going to lone wolf it, right? I get that, man. I've been there. I've led communities that have struggled with that, right? But I want you to know something. There's something about getting together and hearing the opinions of what happened on the stage, right? Like Matthew, Mark, Luke, John. And so with that in mind, can I get back to the John passage, right? You're all like, come on, Jim. That's quite the intro. I want to take you back to the John passage, right? Because guess what John and Mark and Luke all have in common? The one thing they all have in common when they retell it is fear and doubt. Fear and doubt, right? And two of them mention this scene. That's Caravaggio's great painting, right, of doubting Thomas touching Jesus's. Now, pause for a second. There is an interesting thing that all three of the writers mention, and it's this one. The night that the women are getting the testimony, coming and telling everyone, Jesus rose from the dead, when their cell phones were buzzing, Jesus rose from the dead, where were the disciples? Every single one of them tell you this. We were scared and hiding behind a door. Now, why wouldn't they be? Friends, there's a couple reasons to hide sometimes, right? One is you've been so disappointed, you go into a hole. And I want you to think about this. The disciples are so confused and disappointed at this moment. They believed in a Messiah that was going to somehow, they really were confused over his 3 years of earthly ministry, how he was actually going to pull this off. But they were firmly convinced their glasses on the world told them that the Messiah wasn't going to come and that we were going to take Rome down, right? So they were watching Jesus, his couple trips into Jerusalem when the crowds would get really big. And I guarantee you the Romans were watching him. I guarantee you there were undercover Roman people moving in Jesus' little throng to make sure they didn't become one of the 17 rebellions that tried to rear themselves during Jesus' lifetime. Jesus' lifetime, there were 17 rebellions led by Jews against the Romans. They just thought he was another one. They were getting nervous because more and more people came. And the disciples had to be thinking, this is awesome. I want you to picture Palm Sunday, right? Palm Sunday, they thought it was gone down. Go read it. Mark says this, as they were approaching Jerusalem, the crowd that followed Jesus was scared. Now, friends, that crowd just marched 2 days from the Galilees because guess what they thought was going to happen at Passover? They thought Jesus was going to unveil himself. And they thought this, we will march against the mountaintop where Herod's temple is, where the palaces, where the temple is, and where the Romans have their centurion go. We will march on the mount from the Mount of Olives. We're going to come up over it. We're going to go down. And Jesus, you just stay behind us. And when we get knocked down, you do what you did to the widow's daughter, to Jairus' daughter, and to Lazarus. You just keep touching us, man. This is a great plan. And then if we fall down and get killed, you just and boop, boop, back up. Like a Nintendo reset button us the whole way into town. And it can just be 100 of us. And I'm counting 120 right now. Maybe 132. It could just be us. You just keep healing us. We can have sticks, man. Woo! This is like Jericho with little peas on the wall. They can make fun of us all they want, but we're taking this down. Sorry, I always have to throw a VeggieTales in. Did I do that, Michael?
I just got so excited, I just started to hit buttons. This thing is so awesome. Look at that. That's like Cavargio if you 420. Look at that.
Thank you. You're a good man. You shouldn't give me these things. And if it had a laser, someone's retina, whoever's fallen asleep, bam, I would just retina you right there.
They thought Jesus was going to take it all down. So they're sitting in that room, friends. And you know what's harder than the fact that the Jews might come and kill you? It's that you've been left down in your beliefs. Come on, friends, what's real fear? Of course, friends, they would be afraid that one day they have to go home and explain to their wife why 3 years they believed in something and she had to keep the household together, right? That's one form of fear, when you have to explain to your friends why you followed someone that didn't turn out, right? Another form of fear is that the Jews could at any moment, the Sanhedrin, with probably Roman guards, are searching your city now, right now. There's 7 gates going into Jerusalem. Every single one of them would have been covered, and there would have been a little MO, a little description of every one of the 12, right? And they would have been watching for him. If you don't believe this, go read Acts chapter 9, where Saul gets to Damascus and gets his scales fall from his eyes, and it says they guarded all the gates to kill Saul so he couldn't leave Paul, right? They had the gates covered. These disciples were hiding because the Jews were on the lookout for him, right? And the Romans were with them because the Romans were worried too about this little zealot group known as, and when, trust me, when the Romans take one down, they take them all down, friends. This is mafia stuff. No one's looking, you just disappear. So they had tons of reasons to be sitting there scared. But you know the hardest one of all? Isn't that I could die or that I got to explain this to my wife, what I've been doing for 3 years, or to my dad, what I'm up to with my life. The hardest one is when you actually believe in someone and they let you down. Anyone? Anyone? Bueller? It's when you believe in something. And not by like, not just believe in it. You staked something on it, and it wasn't what you thought. You go into the metaphorical closed door, don't you? Don't you? Come on, man. Some of you have done it with different things in your life. Relationships that you thought were going to be a certain way but haven't turned out the way they were. Control addictions that we go to kill the pain of living, right? Hopes you had for what your life might look like at this stage that it doesn't. And you secretly and silently just kind of disappear into a part of the city, head to where you used to know Jesus, the upper room, and you just kind of hunker down there and shoop, slide the lock. And here's what Jesus would say to you. Peace be with you. Isn't that interesting? We're told it twice in this passage, right? Shouldn't Jesus have done this with the 11, right? Shouldn't he have come and said, guys, you of all people, you've been with me 3 years, dag nabbit, how long is it going to take? What do I have to do? Do you not know who you are? Do you not know why I picked you, little flock? It's the Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. You're sons and daughters of a living God. Have you not listened to anything I said? How many times do I have to give you breakthroughs? How many times do I have to prove what I do? How many times do I have to do something that radically challenges you so you get it? How many seas do we have to be on that I say peace to the waves? Come on, guys. It's almost like we want that pep talk, don't we? There's this kind of mild masochism in us that wants us to rebuke. I remember when I first wrecked my dad's car at 16. I remember laying in my bedroom crying when my older brother came in because I was scared, all the energy, the adrenaline, the fear. And I just said, when's dad going to come in and give me my discipline? When's dad going to come in and give me away? And guess what? My father only ever told me that it was okay. But I wanted to be what? I wanted to kill the pain somehow by being told that I had failed or something. Because then I knew how to frame that. I knew how to frame being a failure. Instead, this being walks in and actually says this. Hey, man. I get it. I get where you go. I get why you go there. I know why you hide. I know why you try to kill pain. Listen to me. Hey, look at me. God, peace be with you. Dang, that's a good God, isn't it, man? And here's where it gets crazy. Were you reading the passage with me? 1 week later, where are they at? Same dang room. Just that this guy's here this time. Same room, friends. And guess what the scriptures say? They were hidden again because they were afraid. Anyone else like that? You get your breakthrough, you get your insight, you get your hope, and then it somehow slips away, or the devil does some stuff to help make it go away, or you get back into the old relationships, you kill the pain through the old habits, right? And this time, the second time, that's when you really want him to walk in and say, what? Did you not hear me last week? Did you not? Guess what he says the second time when he walks in? Peace be with you. And the second time, guess what he does? He walks through a wall. Because guess what? You double the bolts after you've gotten a revelation, you failed them, don't you? Come on. 7 demons take over this place this time around, right? And you double, triple, quadruple that bolt because now you're shamed that you disappointed someone you didn't, that shouldn't be disappointed, right? And guess what Jesus will do if you have your walls locked? Ooh, I like Jesus. He'll just walk through them. Like, hello. Peace, gang, peace. Friends, you want to know why Jesus can walk through a wall? I think Jesus can walk through a wall for the same reason you can walk through a mist or a fog. Remember your 7th grade classes? There's density in a cloud, right? There's thickness there of sorts. But you know why you can walk through a cloud or a fog? Because you're thicker than it. I want to let you know where I think the real realm is. Jesus can walk through a wall, not because he's some ethereal spirit thing, right? But because he's thicker than this world. We're the Shadowlands, people. We're the Shadowlands. And he walks into our metaphorical hearts and behind our locked doors and says this, get back up, come on. Come on, you're the ones I'm sending. You gotta be kidding me, come on. You can be free of this thing, get up. I'm sending you, you're sending us. Yeah, I've decided not to read a gospel, but instead to send you people, what do you think? Oh no, you don't wanna do that, Jesus. Why don't you go ahead and rate your gospel? No, how about I send you into the world? And I wanna close with this simple thing. Isn't he good to us? Come on. Most of you have seen so much. First of all, to those of you who don't do church very much, very often anymore, for whatever reasons, you need people. It's hard to get all this in this world and the white noise that we live in and all that's being thrown at us without people. And I know people have broken trust, and I'm not sure we won't. But you have not come here for a church. You've come here for a Jesus who wants to speak to you through his people. He doesn't fail. He says, peace be with you. And then there's those of you who have believed for something that just hasn't happened. And you swore he told you it would. And because it didn't come, or that person you've been praying for, you didn't get the breakthrough, or because you thought you believed in something and it turned around and bit you, you push things down. You go into a room. You lock the door. And I get it. In the name of Jesus, peace. He likes to like you.